I love you all. It's a pleasure to be with you here this morning. Looking forward to it, actually. We've got a lot of ground to cover, as is sometimes our custom. Every so often you get up and you realize that you guys have already heard a wonderful sermon today. I'm not sure if anything more needs to be said. Thank you for that breakdown at communion. We would do well to dwell on the reality that we experience every single Sunday that we have the opportunity to commune together and with the Lord. But having that been said, are you guys ready for round two? We've had one message, yes, but what about second message? It was bound to happen eventually. Here we are. Before we get started, though, and jump into our text this morning, want to put a bug in your ear. The shepherds and ministry staff are going to be inviting people who are new members of the family here at Leander to a luncheon later on this month. It's going to be on the 20th. We've got some information assembled. It's been since November, I think, since we've done anything like that, and as such, there are lots of folks who have placed membership here. So just want you to put that on your calendar. If you haven't taken or participated in one of those before, you are going to be on the 20th. We'll send out some information later this week. And also, for those of you guys who have just kind of been coming for a while and consider yourself in partnership with what God is doing here, we want you to be a part of that. And if you want to be a part of that, I want you to know you're more than welcome. And if that's the case, make sure you get with Janet and get your information to her so we can plan to have you and join us. It's going to be really informal, so no pressure. We just want to have the opportunity to have some face time with those who are a part of this family here and with the leadership so we can get to know one another and build those relationships. There are a couple of things in life that are certain. A couple of things that you just can't get around. And usually a statement like this or that conversation always ends up with talking about taxes, which we all love to pay taxes. But for all the time we try to laugh off the reality that Uncle Sam is relentlessly coming for us all, I find that there are a lot of places in life where there are just certain realities that you cannot escape. They just are, whether you like them or not. And we're going to be using that phrase a lot this morning. So I don't know what springs to your mind when you think of things that just happen, whether you like them or not. I think there are some unavoidables, some things that are just part of our life experience. My wife talks about the fact that it doesn't matter how thoroughly you do the dishes, there's going to be new dishes as soon as you're finished, or laundry just keeps happening with an ever-decreasing supply of socks and other things that seem to be gobbled up by mystical elves in the dryer. I think of, if you're from a small town, everybody's going to know your business, no matter how private you are, whether you like it or not. Or if you're running behind already, there's going to be traffic. It's just a fact of life. Or if you're relying on any type of technology, phones, communication devices, especially printers, when the least opportune time for them to not be functioning is when they're not going to be functioning. That is Murphy's Law. If you are the Minnesota Vikings in a playoff game and you have a field goal to win the game, you will miss the field goal. It is a fact of life. We're going to get ahead of this. Football started Thursday. You guys are going to come to me on Sundays and Wednesdays. You're going to be like, what happened last week? I'm going to say the same thing that's been happening for my entire life. It's not going to bother me. Is what we do. Vikings are going to Vike. It's a reality of life. There are just certain things that happen. And my dad actually had a succinct way of putting this, and it was this phrase. And I remember him saying this to me all the time. There are just some things that are going to be this way, whether you like it or not. I think that's a parent thing. Every parent has a way of conveying to a child that there are just some things where we can insert whatever uncomfortable situation the child happens to be experiencing at the moment. But this is just how it is. As a matter of fact, our common vernacular has kind of smuggled this in. We say, it happens to the best of us, or it gets us all sometimes, or it is how it is. And so we start to wrestle with this uncomfortable fact of life. I think it's important that sometimes we talk about these things together because one such reality like this drives deeper than all of the others. It's invasive, it's uncomfortable, it's inconvenient, and it's important that we use those words because if you've grown up in the church or around church, you might not think of it this way, but the reality is when it comes down to it, it's one of those situations that, whether you like it or not, this is how it is. And this is maybe the most whether you like it or not moment in all of history. Pick up with me in Acts chapter 13. Paul and Barnabas are being sent off, formerly Saul of Tarsus. We've been following them through the book of Acts, and now that church Antioch that we spent a little bit of time studying has actually undertaken the mission of planting new churches. And they have commissioned Paul and Barnabas to go, and the first place that they end up that Paul gets to stand up and preach is in Antioch, a different Antioch. I find that to be interesting to me. And we got to take a look at what Paul's first outing is, because I think that makes it very, very important. It tells us a lot about the psyche of this man who has had this uncomfortable collision on the road to Damascus, this man that has had to rethink everything about his understanding about who God is and what his place in this world is. And of course, this falls within the purview of the book of Acts, and this is the earliest history of the church. It's the first sermon that Paul has ever preached, or at least the first one that we have recorded, and it's dominated by this fact that is a reality, whether you like it or not. He gets up in verse 32 and he says, "We tell you the good news. What God promised our ancestors has been fulfilled by the raising up of Jesus." He continues later, he says, "As it is written in the second psalm, 'You are my son, and I've become your father.' So God raised him from the dead so that he will never be subject to decay." He would not see corruption. And what you will find is that this is going to be a constant and obsessive theme from Paul as he goes on his missionary journeys and as he preaches everywhere. This is the thing that he brings with him in the toolkit every single time. It's an obsession. It's his first pitch. I've joked with you before about when you go to preach somewhere for the first time, you never throw your best stuff because then you're going to throw some junk later and they're not going to be impressed. But Paul is going to lead with his best pitch every single time. What we're seeing here is how this specific topic that Paul is dealing with and anchoring this sermon in, what we're seeing here is how the newest Christians, the earliest Christians, responded to this, taught this, believed this, thought about this, and it's a picture of how we should think about it, how we should be anchored in it, and how it should position us in response to God, or maybe how we should position ourselves in response to God. He's talking about the resurrection. Do you notice that everything that happens in his discourse here is anchored around the fact that he points out in verse 30, which was read for us a few moments ago, "But God raised him." And I think there's more to that than meets the eye. There's more than we give it credit for. That word "but" carries so much meaning or weight in our language and understanding today, and I know that it did then as well. Because anything that comes before the word "but" doesn't matter, does it? "But" is a justification for everything to follow. And justification's an interesting word to explore in light of a topic like the resurrection. So Paul says, "But God raised him." Now, I have heard and studied this broken down into two main ideas that Paul is really driving at here in his first message, and I've never forgotten it. I want to share it with you this morning, and I want to be upfront and let you know that my understanding of this is not actually something that is unique or something that I came up with. This is something that hit me and stuck to me, and I've never been able to let it go, and I'm hoping that it's going to be the same for you as well. And that is, firstly, that the resurrection is presented in Paul's very first message. And the first time that a missionary journey happened, that the gospel is going out intentionally in a missional effort, it's just preached as a fact of life. It's just preached as a thing that is. It's understood as a fact. In verse 30, he says that God raised him from the dead, but not just that, but that he was seen by many who traveled with him for many days. He's establishing the presence of witnesses, and not just witnesses that corroborate the resurrection, witnesses that still exist that you can chase down and ask about it to that very day. He would write like this later, "many of whom are still with us. Go and ask them if they saw Jesus." It strikes me that Paul could never make a claim like this unless he was willing for people to actually go and hunt down all the people that saw Jesus. You couldn't make a felonious claim like this close to the actual event. But I think that we need to realize that he's not saying that the early church was a body or a community of people that just saw the resurrection of some sort of whimsical symbol of hope. That even though things went off the rails and even though things didn't go like we thought, there's always hope in the darkness because we believe that God is going to be with us. And therefore, we have this symbol of the resurrection. No. He's not preaching it like that. It's not understood like that. It's not taught or received like that. The resurrection is delivered and presented and received as a fact. It's inconvenient. It's paradigm shattering. It breaks everything about everyone's understanding of the world up until that point. But it is a fact of history, whether you like it or not. And this is how Paul presents it to this audience of Jews and Gentiles. There's something about facts that bothers us sometimes. Facts are hard to argue with. Facts contradict our wants and the things that we would like to see come to pass. And I would just like to say that there's no greater example of this than the Apostle Paul. Think about his journey so far. Think about why everything about his message would hinge on the resurrection. Paul hated Christianity. He didn't like it. Everything about it offended him to his core in his sensibilities and his beliefs. He hated what Christians believed. He hated what they taught. He hated how they taught it, showing up as if they're angels in front of the council like they were. He hated how they lived their lives. He hated how they died. It even enraged him. There was nothing that he found to be redeeming about Christianity at all. He did not like the way. He was willing to kill people just for being adherents of and proponents of and followers of the way. He didn't like it. He hated it. But there was an inconvenient fact that even though he was offended by everything that Christianity was, when he saw Jesus risen and knew he was alive, it didn't matter what he thought. It didn't matter what he liked. It didn't matter who he was, his authority, his reputation, his upbringing, his schooling, his sensibilities, his likes, dislikes, loves, passions. None of that even mattered. All that mattered was that Jesus was alive, whether he liked it or not. So what do you do with a paradigm exploding reality like this? Jesus was alive. Now, I'm going to go down the nerd hole for a little bit today. It's been a couple weeks since we did that, but I want to make sure that we understand the world that Paul was living in and who he was talking to. And I also want to make sure ahead of time before we get there that you understand that these were just not some gullible folks who we assume just took things at face value and we are more learned and we're more understanding than they were, and therefore what they believed is not what we ought to believe based on what we know. Because Paul wasn't the only one. Historians will actually tell you that the fact that Christianity got off the ground with the Jews in the first century is one of the mind-boggling facts of history as it was. And the reason is that out of all people, Jews, first century Jews, were the least likely to ever believe that God would ever be found in the flesh as man. They're the least likely to ever believe that even such a thing was possible. Now, they lived in the Greco-Roman world. We know the Greco-Roman myths. We know, you know, you grew up watching, you know, Hercules and these things and these demigods and these half-god, half-men. The Greeks and Romans thought that this was kind of a thing that could happen, but not the Jews. Actually, for the Jews, it was blasphemous. Actually, for the Jews, it was absurd to think that God could be man or found in the form of a man in any way, shape, or form. Hence, the condescension, hence the persecution, hence the stonings, hence the beatings, hence the crucifixion. Jews were not the type of people to believe that this could even happen. It was outrageous, it was crazy, it was blasphemous. And there was also the fact that Jews, some of them, believed that there would be such a thing as a resurrection, but it was going to be at the end of time when the entire world was renewed, and everyone's going to be resurrected at once, but not one guy in the middle of time when everything else is still the same. And Caesar is still on the throne in authority. And this guy not only is just not resuscitated, he's different and can eat breakfast with his brothers on the beach and pass through doors. So he's not just resuscitated, he's resurrected in something else entirely. So for those reasons, you have to understand that what Paul is saying in Acts chapter 13 in this synagogue and in front of this audience of Jews and Gentiles alike is the most preposterous thing that could have ever been envisioned by the Jews. And so even non-Christian historians look at the history of the church and they say, how did this ever get off the ground in Jerusalem, in this climate, with this understanding? Hang with me here as we move on, knowing that this is exactly everything that a first century Jew should have rejected, just as Saul originally did. It's important to us modernly, because our modern worldview is pretty skeptical, is it not? This is a praying church. This is a church that believes in intervention by prayer. This is a church that still believes that God can do what God has always done in ways that only God can do it. And yet, as we talk about intercessory prayer last week, we have some folks saying, amen, I've seen it. And some folks whose eyebrows still haven't grown back when I suggested that God might do something like that. It's just the nature of the world that we live in. This Western post-enlightenment, scientific, naturalistic, rational worldview says that things like this don't happen. And what our assumption is that we don't believe that a resurrection is possible because we are more educated than they were. But here's what I want you to consider. We find the resurrection hard to believe because of our worldview, that Western scientific worldview. But the first century Jews also found the resurrection hard to believe for different reasons, but because of their worldview. And so a succinct argument that we can make is that think about whatever kind of evidence you would need to believe that Jesus actually rose from the dead. Think about what it would take for you to actually grasp that this happened and believe that it was true. And all you need to know is that those first century Jews had to have gotten evidence just as strong. Whatever it is that you would need to be convinced that Jesus got up, that in verse 30 it's true that God raised him, these Jews that we're dealing with now got evidence just as strong. They were just as skeptical. Paul was more skeptical. But then he saw that Jesus was resurrected, and when he saw that, he had to move differently and live differently. It didn't matter that he found Christianity outrageous, offensive, appalling. He had to deal with it. Jesus was the wildest and most blasphemous and most injurious thing that Paul could have ever conceived in his personal convictions in life as a Pharisee, and yet God raised him. And because God raised him, and because it was just a fact, whether he liked it or not, it changed everything. I want to suggest for just a few more minutes this morning that Christianity has a tendency to do this to people. It has a tendency to rub people the wrong way. And I don't have the market cornered on this, but I think I can suggest to you why. If you wonder why people get so agitated about Christianity, it's because of this statement right here. Nobody likes to hear this. Did you ever like to hear this as a kid, whether you like it or not? Do you like it as an adult that there could be a reality in existence that you're just beholden to, whether you like it or not? What we hate more than anything as humans is not having control and not being able to decide. Most worldviews and religions out there they all have beliefs, they all have tenets, they all have teachings, and the way that we like to decide whether something is true or not is whether we like it. So you can decide if you like the Eastern religions and Buddhism and Hinduism. I like the idea of finding peace, and I like the idea of being calm and being stoic in every situation. Or you can decide if you like the idea of naturalism. The problem with Christianity is it doesn't leave that to us. Because if Jesus rose from the dead, that demands something of us regardless whether we like it or not. It doesn't leave it to us to decide if we get to reject or accept Christianity based on what we like. Paul was so offended by Christianity, he was ready and did kill people for it. And there's probably not anybody you're going to encounter out there this week that feels that strongly about it. But what I'm trying to hammer home to you today is that Paul was confronted with a reality so true that it didn't matter whether he liked it or not. And it doesn't matter whether we like it or not either. the fulfillment that the resurrection brings, though, we're going to get to something that feels a little bit better. Because I don't know if I've ever undertaken a project of preaching the resurrection so negatively as I have in these first 13 minutes. It's not bad news, it's good news, but I just made it sound like bad news. So the fact of the resurrection can be bad news and offend our human sensibilities, but the fulfillment that the resurrection provides is what makes it good news. So let's talk about that for just a few seconds. So the resurrection was preached not only as a fact, but fulfillment. Paul says in our text today, the promise to our ancestors has been fulfilled to us through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, we are running short on time today, so I'm going to sum this up. What were the promises that were given to the ancestors that Paul is talking about now? You could sum them up by saying they are promises about what the future is going to be like, what the future world and reality is going to be like. Plans to prosper you, Jeremiah would say. Isaiah would talk about the coming kingdom and the coming Messiah. Prophecies of all nations flowing into the mountain of the house of the Lord, of swords being beaten to plowshares. The promises to the descendants of Abraham. And you have to ask yourself, these promises and this fulfillment, how did they overcome the world that they were living in that day? Because they're not living in a time of inconsequential or non-influential people. The fulfillment of these promises happens in the time that gives us Aristotle and Socrates and guys that, you know, Pythagoras and all those other math dudes that I don't really know a whole lot about. Like great thinkers, influential thinkers, people that lived by and created and honed and polished philosophies that are still very much present and people are living in today. But how is it that Christianity and this Jesus and this resurrection amidst all of that cancels all of this within a span of 200 years? If you're looking at the same historians that I referenced earlier, I think Tom Holland does a great job of this in his book, Dominion. He's a secular historian, but he talks about the rise of Christianity and how it's influenced things actually in a positive way, counter to sometimes the popular narrative. He's talking about how the fact that it was this teaching of the resurrection that set the world on fire. So there are lots of religions and worldviews that want you to live with honor. They want you to be good people. They want you to have morality. They want you to have ethics. But it was this understanding of the resurrection. This thing that Paul is saying, but God raised him, and this is good news and a fulfillment. And then later in the chapter, when he says that he has made them a light for the Gentiles, that they may bring salvation to the ends of the earth, and everyone starts cheering and rejoicing, is because of this hope of the resurrection. It is nothing that the world has ever seen. It's based in the Old Testament, but the Jews weren't expecting it, and the Greeks and Romans certainly weren't expecting it. There is nothing like it. The hope of the resurrection is unique. There is still nothing like it to this day. Allow me just a few moments to unpack that for a second. If you'll just rock with me, I know we've been here a minute today. This is big. We got to get this. We got to get this. There's no hope like the resurrection. The resurrection was so appealing to the world. And these missionary journeys that are beginning right here at Antioch City are going to be so successful. And the entire world paradigm is going to be turned upside down. And you, as a Christian today or a seeker today, are a result of it. Because the resurrection made the future exist. One of the main streams of thought that was prominent at the time came from a guy named Epicurus. You guys know who Epicurus is? Yeah. The Epicurean philosophy was that this life is all there is, and then you just, there is nothing else. And the Epicureans were known for the eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die type of lifestyle. But he just said that when you die, you just die. That's it. There's nothing after that. It's non-existence. And because it's non-existence, you don't need to be afraid of it. And you should just try to be as happy as you can now, because this is all you get. And commonly, have you found that people live by this today? We repackage it. We say live while you're young. More annoyingly, we say you get one life. And even more annoyingly, sometimes people still yell YOLO and I just want to punch them. But Epicurean thought just repackaged. It's the same thing. It's enjoy life while you got it, because that's all you get. Now, the Sadducees were a Jewish sect, and they believed this too. They didn't believe in a resurrection. But not all Greek and Roman life people believed in this. There was another popular belief that was just kind of like, we're not sure what the underworld is like. Well, you know, there is an afterlife. The Hadean realm could be good. It could be bad. We're not sure if it's dependent on whether you've lived a good life. We're not sure if we're just at the mercy and of these petulant gods. We don't know what that looks like. And the Stoics said, since you can't know, there's no business really getting that worked up about it because, you know, you can't control it. Stoic philosophy is still really strong today. It's making a comeback right now. Pay attention. So there was this idea that the resurrection comes and actually just lays waste to the fact that you can't know whether there actually is going to be something after this. There was another line of thought, and that's that the resurrection is personal. This is really the last thing we need to examine on this, and I hope you get it. I want you to really think about this as Christians, okay? There's also this Eastern way of thought where there is an existence after death, but you just go into the great ether and you become part of the bright circle. We call it the Lion King philosophy, right? Yeah, you come out of the dirt, you live, you go back in the dirt, the antelope eats you, and then, you know, you're just part of this great ether. It's an impersonal existence after death. You don't have to be afraid of it because when you die, you continue on. You're just not you anymore. You're just part of the great circle of life. But there's a problem with that. Both a non-existent future or an impersonal future means that the ultimate destiny of every person has no meaning at all. And if it's an impersonal future or a non-existent future, then you forfeit the very thing that you know makes your life worthwhile living right now. What is the meaning of life? Don't give me the Sunday school answer. To serve God and glorify Him. Yes, we know. But what's the meaning of life deep in every human's heart? If you really tear everything away, we only ever find anything stable at love. That's it. Love is the point. Love is the answer, it has been commonly said. Even the people of the most secular worldview will say that love is the point of living. And it's the only thing that gives us meaning, and it's the only thing that gives us hope. So you want to say to me that in your non-existent existence after death, or your non-personal existence after death, where there is no love, there's nothing but love lost, that I shouldn't be afraid of that? That that's not absolutely terrifying? That you want me to live my life for this one thing that you says give me meaning, and then after it's over, that is all taken away? And that I shouldn't be afraid of that? That that should be okay? That I should just accept that? That this is actually somehow good? Here's what I think. I think that the Stoics and the Epicureans in ancient Greece and the Roman Empire knew they weren't being honest about that. And I think when the story and the reality of the resurrection came to them and it said that there is a certain future and it is a personal future where you are still you and the people you know are still the people you know and there is still love and that's what it's about forever, I think when they heard that, they realized they'd been lying to themselves and it set their hearts on fire. And it changed everything. And I don't see where that message doesn't set our hearts on fire today. This resurrection, this certain personal future, and that it's for us stamped with the resurrection. The resurrection means that our future is there, it is personal. And it is certain for anyone who is in Christ. That's what it means. And I have a lot more that I want to say on this, but we've got plenty of time to do that another day. Here's what I do want to say to you, though. When you are young, the cross will mean a lot because you start to realize you've messed up. But the older you get, the more the resurrection starts to rush up to meet you. Because what is life but a continual grind of having the things that you hold dear and mean the most to you chipped away? First, you notice that you roll out of bed one day and you're injured, and you don't know how you injured yourself. And you think, no, I'm good, it's just gonna, but you realize soon that your back just keeps hurting, and then your knees, and then your ankles, and then your fingers, and you realize there's no going back from that, it's irreversible. And then you can't remember things. And you're mad that you can't remember things. So when someone tells you you don't remember, you say, I do remember, and you're dumb. We just deflect. It's irreversible. And then we lose people. And as we get older, these irreversible things happen to us. And the cross is beautiful and moving, yes, but the resurrection, the resurrection calls to us, because the resurrection doesn't just mean that I'm okay. It doesn't just mean that I'm not being condemned. It's a reversal of the things that feel irreversible. When Paul walked into that synagogue, when he started preaching, he started to say to old men and young men and old women and young women, look at your hands and how much they hurt right now. Look at the wrinkles. Look at... It's all going to be reversed. Look at the way that you limp and you can't walk. Someday you're going to dance again. Look at the way that you can't sing like you used to sing. You're going to sing. Look at the way that you can't remember. You're going to have perfect clarity. Look at the way that you feel when you think about those who you've lost. You're getting them back, and they're not just ethereal antelope food. They're actually them, and you're actually you. And when people laid hold of the reality that is what the resurrection means, they stopped saying, this Jesus is annoying, but it happened, whether I like it or not. And they started saying, actually, I kind of like that idea. Jesus got up whether you like it or not, church. But don't you actually kind of like it? Don't you want to like it? Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to know that it's true? Don't you want to know that the you that is you is that valuable and that loved, that you have a future, that it's personal, that it's certain, and every awful thing in this life that feels irreversible is going to be undone? That is the message of the cross. That is the reality of the resurrection. That is the truth. God raised him, whether you like it or not. If you're here this morning, and your heart has not been set on fire by this message, the truth of the resurrection, I hope that it is now, and I hope that God brings you to that place. Or if you're here this morning, and you just haven't thought it out, you haven't thought the power of the resurrection actually means, and you've been walking through the valley of the shadow of death, but you've been walking as if there is not life on the other side, we invite you to come. Pray with us like we talked about last week, so that this can become a real and blazing, inconvenient, but beautiful, wonderful, hopeful truth in your life. Will you come as we stand and sing?